While a publication might attract a following for eye-catching design, the secrets to success run far deeper than a fancy front cover. Standing out on the newsstand is an art form all of its own, and a delicate, carefully crafted one at that. We'll dig through the pile in our quest to discover what makes a cover pop today on The Stack. From Byron Bay to London's Paddington, we're assembling a healthy lineup of some of today's and yesterday's very best magazines across the globe as we delve into the nitty-gritty of eye-popping imagery and the finest font making.
Somebody's produced one-woman show here, produced an incredible magazine. I think in the back of their minds, they always think the passion, the love, the labour of love, that in itself is going to make something collectible. You've really put that blood, sweat and tears into it.
We'll touch down for lunch on the beach in Australia with a magazine that's as dedicated to its covers as it is to its words.
The environment where we live has a huge influence on not only the recipes, but also the philosophy of parenting. People are slowing down in these regions. It's not about doing to-do lists and rushing off to piano and then rushing off to judo and doing all of these things. It's actually stripping it back.
Plus, fancy front pages aside, how do publishers and purveyors make sure that a magazine is seen? We'll pop across town to Monocle's Kiosk Cafe for a chat with our team that's dedicated to doing exactly that. All that ahead here on The Stack, Monocle 24's dedicated print industry review and analysis programme. Hello and welcome to The Stack with me, Tom Edwards. James Hyman is a good friend of ours here at Midori House, and I'm delighted to say he's joined us once again. James, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Behind or in front of the Hyman Archive?
I'd say I am in front of it.
You're in the midst of it.
I am. I have to be front line.
And we should remind our listeners, I'm sure they remember, it's extensive. The world's largest collection? It's somewhere in that ballpark, isn't it?
It is the world's largest collection. It got that in 2012, but it's practically doubled through donations. I mean, amazing through the PR and social media that we've had. 25,000 magazines over the last couple of months from 130 different donors. They've sort of picked up on it online and through social media, and it has just been amazing. The quality of what's been donated, the people, the stories behind their donations, just amazing stuff.
Well, we're going to touch upon a couple of those stories because I know you've got a couple of, talk about archive, we've got a couple of real classics which we'll come on to. Where should we start though? I mean, I guess the fact that it gets this kind of engagement, the fact that the collection grows, the fact that you can supplement it with brand new titles as well as classics must leave you feeling fairly positive about broadly the sector, especially independent magazines.
Ridiculous.
There's plenty of good stuff happening.
There is so much stuff. There was a report, Tori Turk, who's the amazing archivist at the Hyman Archive, forwarded me the other day. Independent magazines are thriving. Magazines in general are thriving. So if we're just talking specifically about that area, I never, ever have any fear about that. I mean, I always say this, go into some of the top Soho newsagents, you will see so much new content. I mean, a newsagent near me that doesn't really have that many stuff, I walk in there yesterday and I pick up this, you know, the Journal of the London Society, never seen that before, twice annual magazine, but the old stuff as well. What I found interesting with these people who have been donating is the stories behind their magazines and the emotional attachment they have to them. They can't chuck them away. I mean, it was best summed up in a letter here. Someone from Twickenham anonymously wrote me a letter on the 7th of March. I think it was female. The tone of it sensed it was a female. And it just said here, I found the enclosed in my parents' loft. She basically sent in these incredible women's magazines from the 30s. Couldn't bear to throw them away. If you have to consign them to a paper bank, then so be it. I won't have to go through the trauma. Yours faithfully, someone eternally grateful to someone like you. And this is it. I think magazines, you know, especially in this digital age, people don't, they love that physical artifact. No one, you know, people like people who are loving vinyl again. It's just, you need it.
Well, we talk about that all the time and how, you know, it doesn't matter that even if magazines were originally devised as ephemeral objects, they can become collectible, certainly if they stand the test of time. And new titles set out knowing they're going to be collectible. They're bookish. They're things to be displayed and handled as much as read for the content. Do you ever think that maybe people put the cart before the horse, though, and maybe get too sidetracked in trying to ensure their collectability and their special status? Does it sometimes cause people to maybe take their eye off the ball content-wise?
I don't think so, because I think having met so many, and a good case in point, we can mention her magazine, Fox Pop, is Amy Freeborn. She basically is a good example of somebody who's produced one-woman show here, produced an incredible magazine. I think in the back of their minds, they always think the passion, the love, the labour of love, that in itself is going to make something collectible. You've really really put that blood, sweat and tears into it.
James, we're kind of touching in today's show at, I guess, I don't know what you'd call it, newsstand appeal, you know, front cover pop. How do magazines grab you? And I wonder, you know, you're quite literally seeing more than most, well, possibly more than anybody, depending if you're casting your eye over the archive. What makes you take a second look then when you see something new? Now, clearly, if a magazine references another magazine, as is the case here with Gym Class, which we'll talk about in just a second, that's going to grab your attention. But
yeah, it's a good question.
Are there any principles that you think generally people could usefully stick to achieve that?
Depends on your state of mind, because you see, ultimately, it's your own taste. I think, you know, you can be grabbed. You're obviously grabbed visually, because text in itself is visual. A striking image, a great font, they're the things that grab you. Lots of colours. But I mean, two examples I was thinking of. The July 15 issue of Vanity Fair had Caitlyn Jenner. Striking cover as an image, but something could be topical, the content. Donald Trump, for example, I bought a Rolling Stone the other day, I had an illustration by Robert Grossman, not probably his best illustration, but it was the content in itself. I thought, oh, I want to read that whole on the campaign trail with Donald Trump, or I want to read this Caitlyn Jenner exclusive. But really simple rules, yeah, very striking font or an image, simplicity, lots of colours. And for me, I change over time. Often it really will be what is in that magazine. If it could just be a headline of Robert Crumb or somebody in there, then it's like, wow, I'm going to buy that for that very reason.
So, and that, I guess, reassuringly suggests that content remains king, which is something we always come back to.
Content is king.
If you've got great writing, people are going to read it. If you have great photography, people are going to read it / look at it.
Yes.
And that never really, that's not really cyclical, is it?
No.
It's just the way.
Rule of thumb.
I mentioned Gym Class. Tell us about this, because this is, as I said, it's a bit sort of self-referential.
Yeah.
Remind our listeners, first of all, if they're not familiar with Gym Class, what's their kind of deal?
Its great tagline is the magazine about magazines, and it does that superbly well. I just love the enthusiasm in this magazine, the way they cover magazines, their layout, the typography, what they feature. They kindly feature us in this current issue using an image from the archive. They've taken the face, May 2002, with Eminem wearing a pink tank top. This issue got pulped. And it's brave of them to put this on the cover. I doubt Eminem would really want to sue them for that. But this, apparently, he didn't like.
He might have mellowed in his
I think he's mellowed decade, in his old age.
But you know, you have a copy.
So I have a physical copy of that. There were five different covers, I think, four or five different covers of Eminem in different coloured tank tops, the pink being the rarest pulped one. And we have one, and Gym Class have let that image live on in this great spring-summer 2016 issue. Fantastic magazine, talking about magazines and what's going on in that magazine world. Love it.
Now, we might have become a bit meta here, James. It's a magazine show on the radio about magazines.
Yes.
And we're talking about a magazine that's about magazines.
Yes.
The man who collects magazines.
There you go.
But this
very Doctor Who, loop after loop.
It proves that we love magazines, if nothing else.
And I'm honoured to be on the stack with a show that literally deals with magazines on radio.
We're going to carry on hearing from Jane. There's plenty more, actually, in his stack, including, it's probably the heaviest magazine that we've had, I would say.
Could well be. Possibly the most pages.
It might be the fattest as well. So you'll find out what that is and more as we carry on hearing from James Hyman here on The Stack in a moment or two.
Meet the Writers is the show in which we have a chance to get intimate with some exciting authors. Airing at 1500 every Saturday and available as a podcast thereafter, it's an in-depth discussion about the life and work of a different writer every week, with me, Georgina Godwin, on Monocle 24.
Publishing creatives the world over spend hours concocting all manner of weird and wonderful ideas in a bid to entice eager readers into their pages. But what happens next? The secrets behind attracting readers run far beyond the printed page. Well, barely a day goes by without the folk at Monocle's own Kiosk Cafe pondering the many aspects to presenting fine print. The shop stocks more than 150 magazines, and there's even a print-on-demand machine that, as if by magic, conjures a printed version of just about any newspaper from anywhere in the world. Plus a handy coffee shop, too, for those who need a subtle caffeine hit with their daily read. Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco visited the Kiosk Cafe just across town in Norfolk Place, Paddington, to uncover the secrets behind presenting print.
Letterpress printing has three distinct types of work. These are, first, composition, the preparation of the type or other matter to be printed for the presses. Second, press work. And third, bindery work, the folding or joining together of the printed sheets into various forms so that they may be sent to the public.
I'm Maverick Petter-Taylor and I'm a sales associate at the Kiosk Cafe.
And Jamai Lim, also a sales associate. at Kiosk Cafe.
Can you tell us, I mean, how has it been since the Kiosk Cafe opened? You know, do you have like your regular customers already? Do you think you're part of the community in a way?
Yeah, sure. We're part of definitely part of a Paddington community and a wider community of magazine lovers and people who know the brand and everything. It's really great to see people still buy magazines and still like to travel to kind of hear about them and read them.
I wonder which type of customers you have. Do you have a lot of people going perhaps to Paddington Station, going to the airport, or do you have local residents? Which kind of people did you notice coming in?
Yeah, it's quite a mix. I mean, on a daily basis, we have a lot of regulars from the local area, from workers at the hospital. There's a few design studios around here. So they come in most weekdays for their coffee. But then we do, it tends to be like early morning and late evenings, we'll have the odd customer coming through en route to Heathrow, which is good to see that people have found that we're here and are making a point of stopping, you know, before they head off to Heathrow on the train.
Let's talk a little bit about the space. I mean, it's quite a, it's a very cute place. I wonder if one of you guys could perhaps describe a little bit, and how do you put the magazines on display? How do you choose which magazines you put on the high spot? And I can see Courier has a quite a nice position there.
Yeah. So it's kind of loosely categorized, but we do have kind of like divisions of like lifestyle, architecture, Japanese titles, which we love. And we have a main table, which are probably like our best sellers and our new arrivals, which is usually a mix, and they're usually the ones that the customers are attracted to most. For instance, Courier, Kennedy and Zeit, we can really engage the customers with those kind of magazines.
And can you name perhaps a few of the best sellers here at the Kiosk Cafe?
Yeah, sure. I mean, we have a couple of sort of smaller independent titles that are doing really well. One's called Vestoy, it's like a fashion periodical. It's continued to sell really well the last couple of issues, and the current issue on failure is really fantastic. And Kennedy as well, it's a sort of journal of curiosities published in Athens. They're sort of staff favourites, so we tend to recommend those, but they do quite well just because of the content itself. And then other titles as well, sort of like Delayed Gratification, The Gentlewoman, sort of more well-known titles, these are kind of big sellers.
Do you guys always are in search of new titles as well? Or, for example, since you opened the Kiosk Cafe, did you add the titles, or are you still adding some more?
Yeah, certainly. Although I was a magazine lover before, I've just discovered more and more, and there's been more and more suggestions from outside. And we can actively look for some good new publications, but while staying true to like a really nice refined list of titles we stayed with from the beginning.
Besides the lovely cinnamon buns I can see there, which I might try in a bit, my favorite thing in the Kiosk Cafe actually is that machine just under us, hot off the press. I mean, can you tell us about it? To be honest, I haven't seen another one in London. I don't know if it's an exclusive here, but it looks quite nice.
Yeah, I think we're the only people doing this kind of service in London, certainly at the moment. It's a great service. We just get all the daily papers from around the world onto our laptop each morning. People can come in, select a paper from our title list, we'll download it for them and print it here on the spot. Yeah, it's really great. We have over 2,000 titles from, you know, all around the world. And it's proving popular. Like, people like yourself, they're finding it really interesting. It's something they've not seen before. Today, for example, we printed off a New York Times, the American edition, which is quite hard to get hold of over here, using an international version. And yeah, it's great. We print it on really nice papers, so it still has that quality of the newsprint. I mean, it's just £3 for any paper, so it's quite an accessible thing for people to get involved with.
Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco there, diving through an ocean of magazines at Monocle's Kiosk Cafe over in Paddington. Still to come on the stack, more from James Hyman, and it wouldn't be Saturday without a visit to Australia's perpetually sunny Byron Bay for lunch on the beach. Stay tuned.
How do you write a biography? Are we all curators today? Who still makes fanzines? And how close are fact and fiction? These are some of the questions constantly puzzling us here at Monocle. So each week on our culture show, we spin the globe to find the very best writers, musicians, artists, gallerists, filmmakers, commentators, and even mudlarks to debunk these cultural mysteries. Tune in to Culture with me, Robert Bound, every Monday at 1900 UK time, where all will be revealed.
You're back with The Stack. I'm Tom Edwards. James Hyman still with me, our special guest today from the Hyman Archive. James, we've already been treated to a few of your selections. But let's get historical.
Let's go archive.
Shall we? Now, you talked at the top of the show about the donors and the amazing mags that they send you, but also the amazing stories behind the donors and behind the magazines themselves. A couple of, well, obvious classics. Maybe tell us the tales.
Okay, so just a couple of name checks, really, and very brief. Alan Morris, he's an executive for his friend Alan Scott. He had this most incredible collection of US comics. One of the last wishes of this guy was to find a home. These comics are seriously valuable. There's like 1,500 of them. So that was a beautiful story. Guy Mike Aldworth recently, 150 Tatlers from the 1900s. That is gold dust. Michael Robinson, apparently had to really, someone went and picked them up for me, had to prize these away from him. It was this whole collection of arenas. He really was attached to them, and it was like literally the guy who picked them up for me from the stockroom said, he's not going to let them go. He's not going to let them go. And he did, you know, the final resting home at the Hyman Archive. That did it for him. Former FT journalist Daniel Green, he had a near complete run of Prospect magazine. He wanted to keep issue one, but again, he said, it's emotional, me letting these go. A guy called Eric Musgrave, he was a journalist for over 35 years. He launched for him magazine, you know, that became FHM. Mm. He literally came down, unloaded his stuff off his car. And then two here, which another contributor to this excellent stack show, Jeremy Leslie from Mag Culture.
Our good friend, yeah.
Yeah, he went nuts. Basically, he went to the donations pile. He didn't move for probably about an hour, just literally paralyzed. This, I mean, look at that. If you saw that, I mean, I know obviously we can, you know, put these on Twitter and Instagram so you can see them. But there is a 1928 graphic design magazine called Gebrauchs Graphic, German. I saw that, apart from it looking slightly old in terms of dustiness, that is fresh. And when you flick through this, just every page, the design, the look, the images, there's something in here that reminds me of Plastic Man.
Well, it's incredibly clean. And obviously there's some amazing fonts that some jump out very much of the period. But it always strikes me about incredibly well-designed magazines. Wherever, however far back you go, they seem somehow contemporary. I mean, you look at some of the kind of advertisers inside as well. It looks thoroughly modern, not
just
modernist.
So that was that. And Dulux, first issue, I think this only lasted two issues, Peter Blake cover. Again, these were given to me actually by a guy called Lance Hodgson. He was an amazing retired graphic designer. And his quote, alas, I didn't get to meet him when he dropped them off. He said, they've served me well. But, you know, people do not want to let go of this stuff, or it's rather pulp it. They definitely don't want to. Yeah. So, you know.
Well, and it strikes me actually, James, you're reeling off a couple of those donors, benefactors, call them what you will. Mm. Quite a few of them, you know, okay, an actual graphic designer, a journalist of many years standing. These are people for whom the physical magazines and collecting them, it's kind of part of their trade, but it went beyond that. It became part of their life. You mentioned this almost physical connection to
Lloyd
to
Bradley, actually. Lloyd Bradley came down the other day, contributing editor for Q, Mojo, Empire. He gave me like 1,000 magazines, full run of this golfing mag, Bogey. And again, he was so happy to see it. But yeah, they were his life. But, you know, they were downsizing for whatever reason. They couldn't take them with them.
Well, I guess people like magazine collectors especially have to kind of make a choice. Do they go the way of the Hyman Archive and it sort of takes over? Or do you have to look for alternative options? What's going to happen? I know, obviously, you know, the archive is by its nature, it's a constantly changing beast. What's the plan? Because it feels you're almost presiding over something that's beyond the mere magazine now.
These
are people's legacies. Is that going to change your strategy at all?
I think that's an important vein to it. There are two strategies, physical and digital. Physical, keep that going. A lot of people come down for research. We have some amazing people coming down. Bizarre requests. Someone wanted a picture of them with Howard Marks, who just passed away last week. So they wanted a picture of him in Ministry magazine, issue one that they couldn't find. Someone, again, there was a GQ magazine from the 90s with an article about a fraudster. Someone needed that article because they wanted to prosecute and get this guy arrested. So physically, people come
the
and do
power, it.
The power of the
have.
Magazine. There you go. Physically, there was that. But the plan is, all being well, at the end of this year, we secure a digital license to digitize all that content and really to make it available, very well tagged. So people will be able to search for anything, an image, an article, an interview, a genre, a style, a person. Really, because if you think about it physically, we couldn't cope with all the demand of hundreds and hundreds of people pouring in.
Well, I just imagine you sort of handwriting index cards for eternity, like one of those chimps writing Shakespeare.
So it's got digitally is the way. And again, that's the best way of preserving. If they're all digitized, There's no worry about...
And it's a print resource, and it's all about print and love of print, but it lives digitally.
Spot
it's
on.
An elegant meeting of those two often conflicting worlds. Time is short, James, so let's
the last one. Should we do the last one here?
A couple of others. Well, you've got a couple of others. Let's save the giant magazine till the end. Should we talk hotels briefly?
Quick honourable mention. I mean, this grabbed me simply. Just a striking image of a lovely, luxurious bed. Sleeper, it's a global hotel design magazine. Article again on this guy, Adrian Zecker, who I kind of admire. But just a luxury magazine all about hotels and the beauty
of... And it's quite kind of traditional. I hope they won't mind me saying that. It's glossy, it's beautifully shot, lots of space for the images to breathe. It shows you can do something classic.
Yep.
And it still finds a ready audience.
Space to breathe also. I'm picking up on you there on the new Playboy.
Well, let's talk briefly about this, because obviously it's changes and, you know, sometimes demises and then renaissances have been well documented. Where do you stand on this then? This is the...
I liked it. So I bought the latest. You know, obviously there was this whole thing about, you know, we're going to not have any of the nudity in it anymore. There is still nudity, but it's very, very subtle. And I liked it. It does give you room to breathe. Nice article from Brett Easton Ellis about the whole nudity change. And I liked it. It reminded me of a kind of bit of Esquire, bit of GQ, bit of 90s details. And it's good. They've done a good job on the new branding there.
What about, just briefly, a bit of old school Playboy? You know, not to sort of get into that old joke about, you know, I only read it for the articles. But, you know,
but I do.
It used to be amazing writing, you know, whether it was like great essays or bits of journalism, long form you'd never read elsewhere. Are they sort of outwardly,
I think that's coming back,
their commitment
yes,
to that?
Yes, I think that is coming back with the likes of Brett Easton Ellis. I think hopefully that will
big hitter,
be that
without any question.
Exactly.
Yeah. Excellent. Well, come on, let's finish with a bang, if you will, which is the noise this would make.
Well, this is... There you go. I needed
that,
this.
That literally made the table shake.
I needed a new coffee table, bedside table, even a chopping board. And what better than to buy the new issue of Pop? 650 pages for £6.50. So you're talking, what, 1p a page? But this is awesome. Look at that.
It's heavyweight.
Literally,
it's shiny.
A coffee table magazine that can be your coffee table.
Yeah.
And it's beautiful.
Now, is that too big? 650 pages? Have you read it cover to cover?
No, I won't. I'll flip mode. I wouldn't, to be honest.
Do you mainly carry it around as a sort of
status
physical,
symbol?
Physical
exercise?
Well,
I told you, it's my coffee table. It's
going
to be there today. It's my little...
So it's function. We talk about form and function quite often. That's a wonderful thing to see. Well, what a great selection.
Thank you.
Of magazines, James. What should we look out for? You mentioned the sort of digitalization process. End of the year,
We hope,
maybe?
We really hope end of the year. And again, if anyone wants to sort of donate or come and visit the archive or maybe use the archive, just hymanarchive.com. It is there for really to help people, you know, appreciate magazines, use content
from
magazines.
Get in touch. And if you've got any more German graphic design gems from the 20s or 30s, feel free to send them along,
Indeed.
Guess is what you're saying to people.
Yes.
James Hyman, it's always great to speak with you. James Hyman from the Hyman Archive here on The Stack. There's another new independent Australian publication being steadily shipped and posted around the world, Lunch Lady. The unconventional quarterly compendium about food and family has some impressive publishing pedigree behind it. You may recognise Lara Burke and Louise Bannister from their former magazines, Frankie and the Smith Journal. The new venture's not just a change of pace for its creators, but also a celebration of the slower life and of the four women pulling it all together. Three live in separate, picturesque Australian towns from Daylesford to Federal. Monocle's Liam Aldous sat down with the acting general manager, Tori Bower, in what's quite possibly the country's most venerable town, Byron Bay, to talk about how place and a slower pace have shaped the new magazine.
So the magazine was founded by Lou and Lara, who were the founders of Frankie magazine and also Smith Journal and Spaces. They basically left the magazine but wanted to continue in publishing, and they then came across a blog which was started by Kate Berry. And Kate had a blog called Lunch Lady, which she started because her daughter Maya was getting bullied at school for her lunches. So Kate was making hummus sandwiches and other beautiful things and was basically getting bullied for the lunches. So Kate said to her daughter, what do you want me to do? Do you want me to do canteen lunches? We can stop this. We can do twisties and sausage rolls. And her daughter said, no, I want to continue. So Kate, who's a photographer, just started doing beautiful images of the lunches, and that's how it started.
And it also represents a real life change for the women behind the magazine as well. They left Frankie and left that whole editorial floor and also had kids themselves. They wanted to do something that kind of reflected their own life, right?
Totally. And I think between the girls, between Lou and Lara, they've got 5 kids, and they realize that no one actually knows what the fuck they're doing with parenting. No one's actually got any idea. And most parenting magazines out there are about, you should, you know, they dictate how you should raise your children, when in fact, you just do whatever's best for you. So they've kind of created a tongue-in-cheek publication that is fun, intelligent, and also speaks to parents as not just caregivers of children, but as actually intelligent people. So there's a mix of recipes and great articles. Well, again, the philosophy was to make a magazine that was completely different to anything else that's out there, kind of like a trailblazer, I guess, like what Frankie was in its heyday. So with Lunch Lady, they selected unique articles about parenting, such as, I mean, I'm a parent myself of a 7-year-old, and there's an awesome article in there by a journalist called Rick Bannister about what to do with grandparents who are actually problem children in themselves. They're the ones that, you know, you say, hey, I don't want to give my kids this, I want to do this, and they go and do everything opposite. So Rick's got a really great article in there about balancing kids and grandparents and what to do.
What are some of his recommendations? You don't have to recall the whole article, but what's in there?
He says, you know what, sometimes you just got to give in to what your beliefs are at home, to when they get through the grandparents' door. That's it. You got to just put your guns down, really, and just go with what they want. And there's another brilliant article in there about a minimalist who has 5 children from memory and how to live a minimalist life with kids, you know, who are non-stop consumers and wants and needs. And he just kind of strips it back into how to live a more simple life.
What about the location? Well, we're sitting here just a few metres from the beach in Byron Bay. How much does this region, this beautiful region, which everyone is clamouring to move up to, affected the editorial line and the magazine in itself?
It's interesting because Lou lives in Federal, which is in the hinterland here. Lara's in Brisbane and Kate's in Dalesford, and I'm in Byron, obviously, as well. And actually, between those places, they have a huge push for healthy food and food that you can buy at market. So I feel like where we live, the environment where we live, has a huge influence on not only the recipes but also the philosophy of parenting. People are slowing down in these regions. It's not about doing to-do lists and rushing off to piano and then rushing off to judo and doing all of these things. It's actually stripping it back and being parents again and slowing down and cooking with them and spending more time rather than just getting caught up in the rat race.
And I love how, as we're talking about that, there's this very frenetic cacophony of construction just behind us. Byron is a very relaxed place, but have you noticed working up here, that's very difficult to kind of balance this running starting up a new magazine, which is incredibly demanding, and wanting to live the beautiful life up here?
Not really. to be honest, I think obviously there's change, and that's inevitable in every place, whether it be a small town or a city, and especially Byron is very iconic in terms of a tourist destination. So it's busy all year round, but we have the luxury of living here of no traffic lights. So there doesn't seem to be the crazy rush and people in suits and rushing to one thing and another and getting caught in traffic. There's nothing like that. And, you know, being a startup magazine, we all just work from home and we have our own agendas. We're incredibly flexible. We all have kids. So if someone's sick, someone's got a sick child, we just go, okay, there's nothing we can do. We just have to hold on. And it's one of the best things about, you know, these girls and creating their own publishing company. They've kind of set their own boundaries for the workplace as well.
Monocle's Liam Aldous there, enjoying the fine pages of Lunch Lady in Australia's Byron Bay. And that is just about all we have time for on this week's programme. Thanks to my special guest, James Hyman, to our producers, Ben Ryland and Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and to our editor, Claire Urban. Comments or queries are welcome as ever. Drop us a note at info@monocle.com. And don't forget to join us at the very same time next week. You can always catch up, if you're missing us before then, at monocle.com or via iTunes. This is The Stack. I'm Tom Edwards. Thanks for tuning in.